Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. The role of news media in a free society is to investigate, inform, and provide a crucial check on political power. But does it actually do any of these things? It's no secret that the goal of corporate-owned media is to increase the profits of the few, not to empower the many. As a result, people are increasingly immersed in an information system structured to reinforce their social biases and market to their buying preferences. Journalism's essential role has been dramatically compromised, and Donald Trump's presidency and his repeated claims of fake news and framing the media as an enemy of the American people have made a bad scenario worse. On today's Project Censored show, we share with you excerpts of a talk that I gave with my co-author Nolan Higdon earlier this year. United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America, and What We Can Do About It. On today's program, we'll share excerpts of that talk with you. Stay tuned.
Unthinkable crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we share excerpts of a talk that I gave with my co-author, Nolan Higdon. The book is from City Lights, United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation, and Post-Truth America. We gave this talk this past October in Berkeley, California, at the historic Hillside Club. Those of you that listen to the Project Censored Show, of course, know who I am, but Dr. Nolan Higdon is a lecturer in history and media studies at California State University, and he teaches at Diablo Valley College as well. He's been a longtime contributor to Project Censored, and again, he's co-author with me of this recent book from City Lights, United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America, and What We Can Do About It. Here now are excerpts from the talk, United States of Distraction.
Sorry, it's a terrible thing to say, but bring it on, Donald. Keep going. It may not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS. Those are the words of the CBS CEO Les Moonves talking about the media coverage of Donald Trump during the primary prior to the 2016 election. And the comment illustrates how the Trump campaign marketed itself as something that the media industry could not look away from. It was exactly what they needed to make profits, and Donald filled a void for them. Donald marketed himself as the anti-politician politician. He would say all the things that you weren't allowed to say, and he'd go all the places you weren't allowed to go. And he had tons of scandals following him around, like Marla Maples and whatever happened in WWE and all these kinds of things. But we were approached by City Lights because they knew that Mickey and I had done a lot of work on media and education. And they said, what's the deal? Why did it work? Why did Donald stand out? Was this media strategy so successful? And Mickey and I decided that we really saw Trump as a symptom, not the problem itself. And that is that Donald Trump will disappear one day, but the problems which allowed him to emerge will not unless we take action. And so we wanted to write a book that kind of told the story of how those problems started to emerge and allowed Donald Trump to be electored into the White House. And we want to go deeper than simply just rehashing the story of how he marketed himself as this media figure, and he was on TV all the time, and how he partnered himself with these white nationalists and white supremacist groups. We wanted to look at why it worked. So we wrote a book about these vulnerabilities in our media and education system that Trump was able to tap into. And Mickey and I, we've been researching this stuff for decades at this point. Me and Mickey have known each other for 15 years. I was a student in one of his classes in 2003. That was the second Iraq war with the second Bush. And we became fascinated with this study, this intersection of media and politics from that moment. As a 18-year-old, I look back and I remembered, I was 18 then, not now. As an 18-year-old then, I looked back, I remember just being so fascinated how you get such a large portion of the country to believe something that was not true to the point that they would support an invasion. That was a huge thing to witness. It was life-changing for me, and I want to know more about that process. So Mickey and I, through our work at Censored and tons of other individual publications and public talks, have focused on studying the intersection of media and politics. And as Trump became elected to the White House, City Lights looked at us. They said, you have to tell this story. What is this story? Help us understand this. And so we wanted to write a book that not only explained how he rose to power, but also ways in which we can solve the problems that allowed Trump to come to power. So we didn't want to write a doom and gloom story about how the world is over and Trump is sort of the final act here. We want to say that Trump's a sign that we need to take action. There are things we can do. And so this book is full of both how we got here, as well as how we can also get ourselves to a better place, probably one that we all wish we were right now. And so we focused in on these four vulnerabilities. We call them these four public vulnerabilities, dealing with media and education. And the first vulnerability that we saw in our current society was what we called a pervasive commercial entertainment culture, filled with like sensationalism, where Americans increasingly value how well they're entertained over how true something is, how authentic something is, how much it means to society, what its impact. We'd rather be entertained. I always use the example of going out to restaurants. I'm old enough to remember when you went out to a restaurant, you went there to eat food. Now you go to have an experience. There's a whole act and a whole thing. It's sort of come into every aspect of our lives. And Guy Debord wrote about this decades ago, about America's obsession with spectacle. We want to be entertained. Neil Postman wrote that we're entertaining ourselves to death. He said that in 1985. I was two. You could see how this entertainment, though, crept into our news as well. I think the most shining example of this is probably Red Eye, which was a show on Fox News Channel. And it took comedians and it put them in the Fox News studio, and they made jokes about headlines. And the goal was to entertain you about news. And what they were really concerned about was that shows like The Daily Show and Colbert Report had been actually stealing their audience. And so rather than figure out a way to make the news more relatable, they tried to make their content more entertaining. And Red Eye was just one of many examples. People like Bill O'Reilly had like a talking point segment where he tried to be entertaining and funny, and he was neither. Keith Olbermann had this worst person of the day where he would have this image and cartoon. He'd talk about who the worst people are and kind of lampoon the ideological enemies of MSNBC, just like Jon Stewart was doing on Daily Show at the time. And then you saw entertainment personalities take over shows, like the Joy Behar show would have like a comedic take on headlines and stuff like that. So this was the way we saw this pervasive entertainment culture start to seep into our news media. And in the 2016 election, some researchers did studies on the nightly news programs, and they looked at the actual content on the nightly news programs during the election season. And they found that in 2008, there was about 220 minutes of actual policy discussion on those shows. In 2012, it dropped to 114 minutes. And by 2016, it dropped to 32 minutes. Comparatively, Hillary Clinton's emails were getting about 100 minutes at that time, when we're talking about 32 minutes of policy. But again, the emails were entertaining, sensationalistic. What's going to be in them? What are we going to find? What does this mean? A policy debate about how to get lead out of water was just not entertaining for the nightly news broadcasts. So that was the first of our vulnerabilities that we noticed, because Trump fit really well into this. Trump came from that TV show, The Apprentice, and people saw him on TV sort of as the man in charge, the know-it-all, doing the hirings and firings and all those kinds of things. Entertainment-wise, so for over a decade, it brought him into people's households. We fit well into that. The second vulnerability we found was what we call hyperpartisanship, that America has gotten to this tribal mentality where we don't really care what the truth is or what's right or wrong. We only care about what it does for our side. We want to win. We want to win, and we want it at the expense of the other side as well. It's very like football-type thinking, sports fan-type thinking about politics. And since the 2000 election, we've started to pick up this discourse about red and blue states. So now you either live in a red state or you live in a blue state. And that means if you live in a state of that color, everyone in that state must be of that color. That's how tribal this conversation has become. We know this from being in California. We still have like Orange County and whatever goes on in the north right corner of the state. It's not that everybody in the state is one color. It's way more diverse politically than we make it out to be. But this red and blue keeps this sort of partisan narrative going. And the studies show that this has crept into our personal lives. Polls showed, like, the 1960s, you didn't think the other party was necessarily bad or selfish. They were just different. Now upwards of, like, 94% of Democrats, 92% of Republicans think the other party is selfish. Also, with each passing year, parents are more and more concerned about what would happen if their child married someone of the opposite party. It's never happened in our history before. And this works its way into weird policy debates. And I always come back to the example of the special election in Alabama for the Senate seat, where the Republican opponent was suspected of child molestation, and he still ran on the ticket. The Republicans didn't take him off the ticket. And they ran in this race against each other, and 48% of voters voted for the Republican, 52% for the Democrat, and the Democrat won, and the 24-hour news network was like, look, civility won. I looked at that quite different. I was like, 48% of people would rather take a risk with a suspected child molester than a Democrat? I mean, what does that say about the level of our politics? This is actually a deciding factor. I didn't realize that it was a partisan issue. And again, this is rooted in our media system as well. Much like the satire news shows like Daily Show and Colbert Report found out, you could tap into a audience if you lampooned the ideological enemy and you kind of overly simplified the world into binaries, right? You're either with us or against us, that type of mentality. Fox had figured out the model for that previously, and they did it by focusing on conservative audiences, blaming everything on liberal boogeymen. And MSNBC was struggling, so they decided to copy the same model, except for they were going to lampoon conservatives. This started people watching news not to learn about what was going on, but to be confirmed in their views and to be confirmed in their hate and opposition to the other side. And that's really feeding a lot of our partisan politics in the present. And some of you may be thinking, like, why is this guy going on about television? This is the digital age. We have handheld technologies and laptops and tablets. In 2016, studies bear out pretty well that television news was still the most influential factor in people's voting as compared to other media. That may change in 2020. But in 2016, television news was still really dominant in influencing audiences on how they were going to vote. But taking television together with these new digital technologies got us to our third vulnerability, which was this fragmented media landscape. We have a fragmented media landscape, and that's a way of saying that through most of human history, we largely shared the same narratives in our media system. If you go back to the 20th century at a time, there was like three or four channels, and we were sort of stuck talking about what was on those three or four channels. I heard about it, I wasn't there. But that was the idea behind what our options were. And newspapers were largely limited as well for as far as national stories. They covered a lot more local stories. So we sort of talked about a lot of the same topics. Well, the advent of 24-hour news networks, we've started to break off in those tribes and find news that confirmed our views. And then the internet gave us a whole new opportunity. We could actually customize what stories and content we want to see. And we thought this was the greatest thing, right? We're going to defeat that evil corporate media by seeking out great journalism. Well, a lot of these tools were designed to do the same thing those 24-hour news networks to do, which was to confirm your views. These social media industries and search engines, their profits are dependent upon you continuously clicking and keeping your eyeballs on the screen. And the studies show that the way we keep our eyeballs on the screen is finding things that confirm our views. So Google search, if I search Google and you search Google, it's going to be two different results. I'm going to get the results they think I want that confirm my views, and you're going to get the results that you want to confirm your views. Same thing with our social media feeds and things like that. The problem becomes that we increasingly are confirmed in our beliefs regardless of what the facts may hold. If you believe that Barack Obama was a Kenyan socialist sent here to enslave the white race, you'd probably be well served by a simple article that disproved what you believe. But not according to Google and Facebook. You need more articles that confirm it, because that's going to keep you clicking. That's going to keep you believing. And unfortunately, that will eventually radicalize you as you find more people who believe these things. So this fragmented media landscape creates a whole new set of issues. Now, it is worth noting that we don't advocate for the good old days. When we had these gatekeepers from the same class and the same media industries, we can't forget the Vietnam War. and how much shared narratives led to Vietnam War and the continuation of that war as well. So this isn't simply a we must go back in time or we must love digital tools. The answer is way more complex than that. And then this gets us to what we saw as our fourth vulnerability. We saw as what we called an ineffective education system. Mickey and I recognize that there was this huge information bomb dropped upon the United States of America, and it's called the internet. And at the same time, it's the greatest thing ever, it's the worst thing ever. It's what Neil Postman called the Faustian bargain of technology. We have access to all of the information, theoretically, in human history or that can be created, but we don't have the skills to be able to find the content we need. And most other countries believed that their education system could solve this issue. And about 30 or 40 years ago, you had nations in Asia and Africa and Europe and Eastern Europe, they started mandating some form of media literacy in their schools. Let's teach students how to use these tools. Let's teach them the dangers. Let's teach them how to find the stuff they need, maybe avoid or at least be aware of the things they don't want to find. We didn't do that here in the United States. We just dropped this information on voters, the electorate, and we said, figure it out. And as we're finding out, most people can't figure it out. And this is not simply a young people or old people problem. We find that the younger generations, they can't find the implicit bias in an article. They're not taught how to tell the difference between advertised content and news content. And then with the older generation, we find that folks over 65 are 7 times more likely to share fake news than people that are under 35. So this is a problem across the spectrum for all media users of all ages. And it's worth noting that we also have another problem as well. They call this digital divide, 2 digital divides. Those who can use the tools and can't, there's a divide between them. And then there's a divide between those who have access to the tools and those who do not. So this is a very big, complex problem with what we called our ineffective education system. There's so many narratives about how we're moving to an online digital world and we all need to get on board and it's the greatest thing. A lot of us are not on board. A lot of people don't have access. Those who do, not all have the skills to use these things. And the way they're being used are not necessarily the most productive for democracy. So these were kind of the 4 vulnerabilities that Mickey and I looked into. And since we both teach history, we wanted to look at the history of how they developed. We recognized they didn't come out of nowhere. And so we focused a lot on this post-1970s. So the 70s is a big transformative decade, not just because Kiss was rocking and punk rock was invented and disco and those things. There was all these other reasons why the 70s was a big transformative decade. The 70s saw the last of these big economic resets. So there's been about 4 major economic models in the history of the United States. We had the half-slave and the half-market economy. We saw that abolished in 1865, and we went into laissez-faire capitalism that we tried to abolish with the New Deal in the 1930s. And then in the 1970s, the powers that be in corporate America and the political class, they started to believe that these unions had too much power politically and economically. The banks in particular were outraged that people were making more money on their banks than they were losing on their interest rate on their homes. And their solution was to do an economic reset. And this was a new economic model called neoliberalism. And the idea was that they were going to push globalization. Corporations could be globalized, but labor could not. This was a way you undercut labor. And once the defeat of the Soviets seemed imminent in these folks' minds, they believed that we could use capitalism to solve the problems that only socialists claimed that government could do. So racism and sexism and wealth inequality could all be solved by the market. If we just cut taxes, deregulated. And their goal was to treat everything as a meritocracy. That is, that we would find a way to measure everything, and those things that were doing well, we would keep, and those things that were doing poor, we would get rid of. This was the very colorblind narrative. It acts like we all start in the same place, regardless of where we begin, and we're all going to be measured the same. Probably the greatest neoliberal experiment that we're all familiar with is No Child Left Behind. There's a multi-multi-billion-dollar experiment to reform schools. And the measurement was, we'll test all of the students, and if they test well, the school will get money, and if they test poorly, the school will lose money. And then we can turn it over to a private company. These neoliberal models gutted cities. Jobs left these towns throughout the United States of America. Folks who had every reason to believe that they could have no college education, get a job, buy a home, have a retirement car in the driveway, money for their kids and college fund. They saw it all wiped away with globalization. Meanwhile, you saw that social safety net that protected folks who were suffering economically disappear with the rise of neoliberalism. You saw a young generation emerge, the first generation in U.S. history, expected to have less wealth than the generation before it. They're told to buy the things that the previous generation received seemingly free, things like college. So there's this massive economic anxiety, and this is the void that Trump sort of steps into. How do we take these real fears that people have, this real suffering that's emerging around the country, and how do you find a boogeyman? Rather than the wealthy or the political class that had designed the society, Trump went after these other figures. He said it's the liberals and media, it's the immigrants, it's the people of color, it's the women. We'll make America great again by binding together and getting rid of these folks. Now, Trump's message was completely factually ridiculous. However, the fact he tapped into some real anxiety, some real vulnerabilities, and was able to use the media and weak education system to his advantage speaks to how Trump rose to power. And so that's the story we tell in the book. But as Mickey will tell you as well, we don't only tell about how this story develops, we also have some solutions, ways we think we can save ourselves from this abyss. Thank you.
I'd like to remind listeners you're tuned to Pacifica Radio's Project Censored show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. After this brief break, we'll continue excerpts from the talk I gave with co-author Nolan Higdon about our recent book, United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America, and What We Can Do About It. Thanks so much for coming out on a Tuesday night. We can work together to create our own narratives from the bottom up, not the top down. And it's an honor to be back here again at the Hillside Club, being here with longtime friend and colleague Nolan Higdon. It was a great honor to write this book with Nolan for another fantastic historical institution, that'd be City Lights Books in San Francisco, Lawrence Ferland Getty's house. So let's give a big round of applause for Lawrence, who just turned 100 this spring. So what a better way to start out this book called United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America, and What We Can Do About It, than with an epigraph from Lawrence Ferland Getty. He once wrote, "Our government is a bird with two right wings. They're devoted to the perpetuation and spread of corporate capitalism." Although neoliberals were able to reclaim some of the financial base from many conservatives of a previous generation, that was mostly the doing of people like the Clintons in the 1992 election. And they said, well, why should we give up all of the bank's money and all the real estate? Why do we have to do that again? Because of liberalism? Well, we could maybe agree with some ideas that are socially liberal and some of the general concepts of people like Franklin Roosevelt or Lyndon Johnson from the New Deal to the Great Society, but maybe we need more fiscal conservatism. Maybe we need to lure that in and see how that goes. And of course, in that election, Clinton was, let's just say he wasn't spectacularly popular. He won with a plurality of 42% of the vote, kind of like Woodrow Wilson in 1912, where there was a split, three-way split. In this case, it was with former head of the CIA, George Herbert Walker Bush. I always like to introduce him that way so people remember who we're talking about. And of course, Ross Perot. And that's right around the time when I was really getting involved in politics, and that was the first election I could vote in. And it was a rude awakening to me. I got to see firsthand how the Clintons were very, very manipulative, very deft at communicating. It was a tough sell. I was in Ohio and Pennsylvania, but those people had had enough, and so they were really swinging out for Clinton. And of course, 2 years later, they got NAFTA, or as I called it, SHAFTA. And they didn't forget it, by the way, which is why another Clinton hasn't done so well in those areas. And we kind of riff on some of that stuff here because we start out the book with a great foreword by none other than Ralph Nader, another octogenarian that's been around the block, that's been fighting this fight for longer than I've been alive. And Ralph wrote a stellar foreword for this book. We couldn't think of anybody to really frame historically what we were saying other than the guy that's been living it for half a century and just fighting that fight and never giving up. One of his last books was called Breaking Through Power, which is like a civics primer that's just like, look, we've got the tools and the institutions, and they're not exactly new. Yeah, we've got newfangled technology, and we've got online activism and hacktivism and fourth-wave feminism, and look at us go. But if you don't go back and learn how to get involved from the ground up into these other elite institutions, your voice becomes extraordinarily marginalized. And, of course, that's happened. And part of neoliberalism was a shutting of the door on working people and on marginalized populations. And, of course, that, in my opinion, is why they have not done so well in some recent elections. They're entirely tone deaf to the most obviously popular candidates that are in their midst. And the corporate media, of course, champions this kind of bias. Just the other day, Bernie Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez had a big rally, the largest rally for the Democratic primary to date, the largest gathering that anybody that showed up. And over at NBC, the headline was, Sanders struggles to regain. They must be watching their own monitors or something, because they sure as heck weren't watching what's going on in the real world. And I'm not sticking my foot into the whole, like, you've got to vote for so-and-so or whatever. That's not my role as an educator or a broadcast person or anything. People do their thing. But what I'm commenting on is this sheer, blatant, and obvious bias of establishment and legacy media against obvious grassroots kinds of movements. I know Bernie's not perfect, and I could sit here and nitpick with all the rest of you about what's wrong with Elizabeth Warren or all the rest of these candidates. Joe Biden, we don't have enough time to get into him, the senator from MasterCard. The point is, we start out here in the book with a really important question, and it's not rhetorical, and it's not meant to be flippant, but it's, how did we get here? I know a lot of people that were into the Obama dream, whatever that somnambulistic era was, and a lot of liberals and neoliberals were kind of like, yeah, we got rid of the Bush years. I'm like, yeah, and what happened to those wars? They grew. And what happened to our economy? Well, it grew for the 1%. You know, it was no accident that you had one of the largest economic protest movements of this century crop up under his presidency, Occupy Wall Street, and one of the largest African-American civil rights movements since the 60s in Black Lives Matter during the first black president's tenure. Well, you know, the identity politic optics, people were like, whoa, this doesn't add up. Great, then retire that and use some different analytical tools, at least merge them together, all the tools we can muster. And so we started out with that question, how did we get here? Well, we went back quite a ways to look for some wisdom, and we found Lao Tzu. If you do not change direction, you may end up where you're heading. Are we there yet? And if we kick in with Les Moonves, you know, right from the top. People like to pretend like, well, I don't know how this happened. Look, it happened by design and because the people that are steering the ship went full speed ahead to here because it benefits a very small group of them. And they like to distract us and dupe us, and they like to manipulate us, and they like to ask us to lend us their support so they can maintain the necessary illusion that this country is representative and is democratic. And it may be some of those things on some levels, but in the grand charade of our federal system, we had to have the pointy-headed intellectuals at Northwestern and Princeton remind what most of the rest of us figured out decades ago, that the United States is in fact not a democracy, it's not a democratic republic, it's a plutocracy. Thank you, Princeton and Northwestern, who's giving us the next batch of plutocrats to keep it going, for the most part. We need to build not just resistance, it's important to say no, and it's very important to resist, but it's also very important to create and construct something else that actually works. Whether it's constructive media like Ken Burroughs, Amber Yang, and Bethany Surface write about in Censored 2020, whether it's creating a real news network in Baltimore like TM Scruggs, whether it's move across generations and write important books about social movements that can strongly influence people in the present to adopt them to new ways that work, like our great friend, the scholar Mark Pilisook. We have the tools, we have the knowledge, we have the wisdom, we have the information, we've got the roadmap, we know how we got here, so we know what way not to go. And there's other paths. And so what Nolan and I do is we go back and we do look. It might not be pleasant, it might be painful, but I'm an historian, I think context matters. And understanding how we got here and what the problems are is an integral part of figuring out not just how to resist, but how to change it and how to build something else. Not just pretending like you're reinventing wheels either. And so that is why I try to work across generations and listen to young people and listen to older people. And then I actually try to do something that doesn't seem to happen very much. Get them in the same room. You know, it's harder to be a complete jerk to somebody when they're right in front of you. You're at least reminded tacitly that there's some element of humanity between you. And of course, this is what this hyper-partisan media silos, the media-saturated society, the dumbing down, the lack of critical thinking, the post-truth era that is foisted upon us, that means it's okay. Your ignorance is as good as my knowledge, and vice versa. And I don't need to learn anything from you. And I don't care if I teach you anything. Well, that's a real antisocial world. And it's ironic that social media, as Siva Vaidnathian has written in a fantastic book called Antisocial Media, about how Facebook is destroying our culture. And so we write again about how did this happen? How do we get here? So we go back, and as historians, that's always a problem. Where do you start? We go back and take a look at, well, even before the neoliberal co-option, we look at people that should be household names, but probably aren't, like James Buchanan at the University of Virginia, who took a look at the New Deal and said, this is the death knell for the moneyed class. These brain trusters and this liberal ideology that's taking over our public institutions needs to be stopped. And so he started creating brain trusts of his own with wealthy right-wing and conservative intellectuals. I know some people say those are oxymoronic, but at least at one point in the United States, there were conservative intellectuals. I'm not sure who some of the greater ones happen to be these days. They seem harder for me to find, but there are some for sure. As much as I dislike people like George Will over the years, it should tell you something about shifting baselines when he seems to be a voice of reason in the Republican Party. Where Rush Limbaugh is bloviating about how if the Republicans don't get behind Trump, they're doomed as a party. George Will is just like, excuse me? Like, let's flip that over. Like, there's not going to be much left of any kind of traditional Republican Party if this keeps going the way that it's going. But I digress. We'll get away from Will. And back to people like Buchanan, who are really influential. And of course, you've heard of Milton Friedman. And of course, he comes out of this era. The Strauss School over at the University of Chicago that gave us a whole generation of intellectual neocons. They fancied themselves as intellectuals in that regard, studying our history and politics, of course, for more myopically selfish and imperialist reasons. So I have a hard time lauding that kind of intellectualism, but it is a kind of one. And Nancy MacLean wrote a great book, Democracy in Chains, that talks all about these characters. And these should be household names. These are the kind of things that people should be learning in junior high. But it isn't like we don't know this stuff. It's that we don't tell each other or we're not teaching it anymore, and No Child Left Behind helped us with that. And so what do students learn? If it's not on the test, it didn't happen. Or if it did, it must not be important. So what are we teaching people? Well, we're teaching them to be ignorant. How ironic. And if we go back and take a look at who these people are, it's the James Buchanans and the Milton Friedmans that edged along the Richard Nixons. And of course, those people eventually gave us the Grover Norquists and the Lee Atwaters and the Roger Stones. You know who else they gave us? Lewis Powell. The Lewis Powell memo might be one of the most important underread documents out of the early 1970s because it's a blueprint for a controlled demolition of our public sphere. I know some people are allergic to terms like conspiracy theory, but this is a conspiracy fact. These people planned it. They carried it out, and they were remarkably successful. They were determined. They had ideas. They spread them. They knew that the demonization of the other is always going to win 50% of the time. And if you can just get people to not listen to others, they'll start just honing in more on you. And they were brilliant propagandists in their messaging. It was with Nixon that they popularized the trope of the liberal media. As Spiro Agnew said, well, more eloquently through the words of William Safire, of course, the nattering nabobs of negativism, as Agnew called the news media. Because Nixon just couldn't hack it that some people in the press were on to his charade, and they were on to what was happening in Vietnam, and Walter Cronkite started to blow that whistle after Tet offensive. And Walter Cronkite, by the way, was an early supporter of Project Censored, and so was I.F. Stone. And that's some of the history that Carl Jensen started, that Peter Phillips continued, that I'm honored to walk in those huge footsteps with Andy and everybody else at our project. I'd like to remind listeners you're tuned to Pacifica Radio's Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. After this brief break, we'll continue excerpts from the talk I gave with co-author Nolan Higdon about our recent book, United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America, and What We Can Do About It. Powell said, look, we got to take over the public sphere. Now, a few months after he's writing this to the head of the Chamber of Commerce in the United States, this is sort of like a forerunner of what turns into the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC. And they're like, look, we got to work together and we got to deconstruct this mess. And it's, of course, none other than Noam Chomsky that I stumbled into this great interview that he did and actually transcribed part of it. He wasn't talking about the Powell memo, but I was writing about it at the time. And anyway, out of one ear, I hear him start talking as I'm thinking about Lewis Powell. And he says, in fact, what's going on in the United States is like a two-level wrecking ball. Trump's role is to ensure the media and public attention are always concentrated on him. He's a con man, basically, a showman. And in order to maintain public attention, you have to do something crazy or nobody's going to pay attention. So every day, there's one insane thing after another, makes some crazy lie. Meanwhile, he's on to something else. And while this show is going in public, in the background, the wrecking crew is working. Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, the guys in the cabinet writing executive orders. What they're doing is systematically dismantling every aspect of government that works for the benefit of the population. All efforts are being devoted, almost with fanaticism, to enrich and empower their actual constituency, which is super wealth and corporate power, who are delighted. And I said, well, Genome, thanks for writing the next couple paragraphs, because this is where we're going. Nolan and I weren't pretending that we were writing some groundbreaking theoretical work here. We wanted to go back and put in one place all of this stuff in one book that was written for a general reading public or high school or college students. They don't have to be experts on Paulo Freire or Henry Giroux, or they don't have to have read all of these other esoteric historiographic accounts by Charles Beard on the economic interpretation of the U.S. Constitution. You can get to that and the Powell memo too. But this is an introduction to all of these things that we try to connect all the dots from the rise of neoliberalism, the enclosure of the commons, the capture of our regulatory agencies by corporate interest, rampant imperialism, coupled with xenophobia and an ironic sense of isolationism in an ever-expanding empire where we're ever fearful of anything other than what's beaming at us on the screens. And we have to slow down, to stop, to go back and remember how this all took place, because this all happened before people knew anything about Donald Trump. Other than being some kind of New York real estate guy who many people in the real estate market didn't really like, a playboy and a gadfly, The Simpsons eerily predicted his escalator ride presidential announcement, right? And so too did the creator of Beavis and Butthead, Mike Judge, in the film Idiocracy. Actually, it was interesting. Judge was interviewed after Trump was electored into the White House. He did Idiocracy in about 2008. And a lot of people said, wow, how did you do that? You know, and he was like, wow, what did I do? He's like, I was off by 490 years. Because in the film, he's like, in 500 years, America's going to be a place run by a show business con man, and nobody's going to be able to think anymore. And of course, that's why when we go to the end of the book, our last chapter is called Make America Think Again. Yeah, hold the laughter. I know someone's going to say, well, when was that, right? Well, I'll tell you, at least 100 years ago in the progressive era and with people like William James and John Dewey and others, there were some people around that knew that there were ways to get people active in their communities, try to create a better, more transparent, less corrupt representative government, and it was something worth fighting for. And during the New Deal, warts and all, people like Franklin Roosevelt and his brain trust made some efforts to try to create a better society with his four freedoms. One of the great talks that Roosevelt gave later in his presidency that most people have forgotten. It's a real hallmark of what that era represents in our history. And if you go back through Powell and Nixon and through the Reagan years, those folks just wanted to rip that to shreds. And Gingrich wanted to deconstruct all of the New Deal. Grover Norquist wanted to shrink government down to the size that he said it could be drowned in a bathtub. Except, of course, for the bloated military and, you know, that kind of thing. So how did we get here, right? Well, and we do. We talk about Guy Debord and Spectacle. We talk about Daniel Boorstin's The Image, who was talking about the problem of fake news and media propaganda in 1962. Eddie Bernays in 1928 saying, this is the way that we should govern you sheep. And it wasn't until 1988 that Chomsky and Herman came out and said, you know what, that's actually not the way to go about this. In fact, this is actually incredibly anti-democratic, and it's extraordinarily harmful. And that's in the 80s, too, when Ben Bedikian was warning about the media monopoly, when 50 companies owned the media, and now we're down to five. So the reason we point all this out is that we've had ample signposts. We've had ample warnings. We've had brilliant people that dedicated their lives to try to help us out. And we're doing a big disservice if we don't listen. It's not just listening, but it's reminding all the people that didn't hear it the first time that there's a lot of information out here that we should be teaching each other and using it to create the blueprints for a better, more socially and economically and politically just world. And it can happen. And in the last chapter of the book, and this is the one thing that Nolan and I agreed emphatically, was that City Lights said, okay, we're going to go with this book. One condition, you cannot do what most of the other authors do. They rain on parades for chapters and chapters, and they deconstruct the problems till doomsday. And then in the last chapter, when there's one paragraph left, they say, but with a little work, I might be able to figure something out. Maybe this is a moment after all. I don't know. I'm going to write another book. Maybe I'll read it then. We said, no, we're not going to figure it out in the next book. We're actually going to have a whole chapter and 70 pages of notes and resources and places to go to get information, get active, and be involved in your communities. And we're going to tell people shouting from the rooftops, here's our websites, here's our free curriculum, here's our critical media literacy pedagogy online, free. Use it, take it, mold it, make it your own, teach us things. And we came up with a list of some solutions and things that we can be working on together. And Nolan chalked these up into what are called the five C's. We like alliteration. We need to rekindle, in all seriousness, civics education and have education be centered around civics in the public sphere. No matter if we're teaching math, science, all of it, it all has to be going through this different lens, this different prism. It's not how much money am I going to make when I get out of here with this information, but how much of this information belongs to the collective of the commons of human history that we can all learn from and build from. That's a different way of looking at it. Critical thinking. Got to bring back critical thinking. I mean, we teach critical thinking, and it's just riveting in the post-truth world that critical thinking just gets relegated to some margin. We don't need critical thinking. We've got alternative facts. And if I don't agree with you, you're fake news. How's that working? It's not working for us very well. And look, I use a great book by these two professors from Bowling Green State University. Western Ohio, called Asking the Right Questions. Asking the Right Questions. It's a real simple book. We use another book by Lee McIntyre called Post-Truth. He's not for it. Like Andy and I in the Censored books, we're like, look, we don't live in a post-truth world. There's empirical facts. There's real things going on, and we need to be focusing on what they tell us. We don't need to just tribalize back down to what feels good with our confirmation bias, with motivated reasoning and inferred justification. That's troublesome. Critical awareness of media, meaning be aware of where you're getting your information and who's controlling it and to what end. And don't just be satisfied, by the way, once you're being aware of this media literacy. Be the media. Get involved in community radio. Get involved in your local journalism outfits, if you're lucky enough to still have them, because they've been under massive assault the last 40 years. Also, we need community engagement and cultural competency. This is community engagement. And the more we look around and see people that are different than we are, the more we're reminded that it's so important to remember that we're not the only people in the world and the only people in the room with the only perspectives and the only backgrounds. And that even though we might be really different, we shouldn't focus on some of the things that divide us and make us so different. We should be looking at how we want some of the same things. And by respecting others' differences, you can then sometimes see past them and find that commonality. And you can all of a sudden find a new friend to work on something with. And maybe even something that you didn't think you needed to work on. You didn't think it was your issue or your problem. And of course, we're ever reminded that we need to do these five things as well. We need to broaden our news frames. And yes, we do need to agitate the corporate media to broaden their news frames. But look, they're doing their jobs well. They're a multi-billion dollar industry that's paid to propagandize the public in the interest of people like James Buchanan and Lewis Powell. That's their job. Chuck Todd over at NBC bemoaned the fact that he can't ask the tough questions of his guests because they'll go to another show. So thanks, Chuck, for admitting you're not a journalist, even though you get paid millions of dollars to play one on TV. But you're also admitting to the public what the real issues of journalism are that the public isn't supposed to see or know about. So thank you, Chuck, for telling us. And thank you, Brian Williams, for lying your way off the air, only to be brought back again to worship military machinery and destruction. Because some people tuning in and watching that weren't so totally Prozac'd out of their minds. And they were just like, is he celebrating like the launching of missiles? You know, there were some people that had some aha moments there. They were just like, what's going on with this? That is one of the silver linings of this fake news conundrum. A lot of folks are starting to wake up about the narrow news frame, and they're starting to ask questions about what they're not being told. And that's a positive thing in the bigger picture. We also need to reinvigorate local investigative journalism. There's a lot of that going on right here in the Bay Area. San Francisco Public Press, the great work that goes on at the radio station, at KPFA, despite whatever infighting and other things that go on that some folks are privy to, you know, there's still a lot of fantastic programming. There are so many things that go on and so many different shows that you're never going to hear on NPR or PBS, which is now being run by the former propagandist from, like, Radio Free Europe. So they're not even hiding that kind of thing anymore. We need educational media. I have students come in and do quick reports and quick news reports in my class that they work on for a few hours, and they come and do 20-minute presentations. Well, you know, that's all you get in network news. You get your nightly news. The local news is 21 minutes. And my students do a better job of breaking up complicated stories in 20 minutes than a lot of these people that are getting paid six and seven figures on these TV stations, because that's by design. That's not an accident. Nolan's whole crew of students helped us shoot a new documentary movie out next month with Abby Martin. It's called United States of Distraction, Fighting the Fake News Invasion. It's a merger of our work in this book and Project Censored and Abby's work at Empire Files. And it's an hour-long educational documentary that has a lot of students, activists, scholars, and people that we've been interviewing for the last couple years at our events. And that'll be available soon. We're going to do public showings here. But our students were a big part of that production. That's educational news media, and they help do it with all of us. It's a joint effort. We also need to really wake up and support real whistleblowers, not ones that pop up like whack-a-mole over at the CIA and say, I think I heard a phone call about Joe Biden, and then he goes back to work. That's not what happens to real whistleblowers like Julian Assange, who is being tortured in prison in England and could barely speak his own name at a court proceeding. And almost no journalists here covered it. Chelsea Manning paying fines, extraordinary fines for refusing to cooperate with a grand jury in the Assange case. Reality winner still in prison. Thomas Drake barely recovered from his jail stint. John Kuryakow prisoned for outing the CIA torture program. We don't support these people. Well, maybe we do. And I know at Project Censored, we long have lauded and supported whistleblowers. And more of us need to get on board and make that happen. We need to do that, and we need more whistleblowers. But we'd maybe have more whistleblowers and Ed Snowden's if they knew they weren't going to get thrown under the bus as soon as they opened their mouths. Which is why Snowden, who, like Manning, offered the corporate media his stuff, and they said, we're not running this. They had to go to foreign countries. They had to go to Julian Assange. They had to go other places to get this stuff reported. Because this is information we have a right to know, that these things are happening in our name and with our tax money in a culture of epic mendacity that tries to cover it up. We have to support whistleblowers because we are, as people like Rene D'Arresta say at New Knowledge, which is an extraordinarily problematic propaganda arm that's an intel contractor for the U.S. Senate, she says we're in an information war, and she's right. But she, much like Eddie Bernays, the nephew of Sigmund Freud, who was an advocate of propaganda and information control, D'Arresta, like Bernays, thinks that these smart people and these technocrats need to control the information we see because we're too ignorant to figure it out. And if you don't think Russia's a problem, you're just not paying attention. You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. After this brief musical break, we'll continue excerpts from our talk on the United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America, and what we can do about it. Stay with us. Well, there's a lot of problems that we face. Like right here, far more influential than Putin or a Macedonian teenager or the Internet Research Agency is our friend Les Moonves at CBS and the people that own the major networks. Far more influential were they in the outcome of the election than any Russian bots ever. But who was over the weekend continually pounding and beating that horse, right? Got to fight the fake news from Russia. That's an epic distraction. And look, I'm no fan of Putin and the oligarchs, and I'm not an idiot. I know other countries want to meddle in elections. We've meddled in 81 since World War II. These other countries can't even keep up with us. And this isn't whataboutism. Yes, they try. But if you think that these obscure ads and these efforts had more outcomes than Hillary Clinton calling people a basket of deplorables, then again, I'd suggest that you maybe go back and rethink that. You go back and rethink where the influence peddling actually comes from in this country. You don't need to go to Russia. You can stay right here. But over the weekend, we were told that Tulsi Gabbard is a Russian asset. Just a coincidence, she's a veteran against some wars. We're also told that Jill Stein is a Russian stooge because she had sat at the same table as these people. I mean, again, it's such a tired trope. I wish I didn't have to keep talking about it. But it's amazing that so many people, including people that otherwise seem to be fairly educated, well, that might mean just successfully indoctrinated, or at least on the other hand, sometimes critical and thoughtful, like the Paul Krugmans of the New York Times, right? I mean, again, the bar is set pretty low there for intellectualism, but he's one of the higher ones. He's bought the Russiagate narrative, hook, line, and sinker. Rachel Maddow turned it into a cottage industry. What else could we be doing? What could we be talking about? If you're curious, pick up a book. Look at Censored 2020 at the top 25, Rachel. As Ralph Nader tells everybody every year, slow day in the newsroom, pick up a copy of Censored and get busy. Because there's lots of stories that great independent journalists are writing all the time. You just won't cover them. Because you're paid not to. And so on that note, I want to conclude again with our very hopeful and very concrete positive message. Riffing on the great FCC former chairperson Nicholas Johnson, who in the 60s and 70s served the FCC and later wrote a great book called Your Second Priority. And he said, regardless of what your first area of interest or your first concern in society is, if your second isn't reforming the media, democratizing the media, and making the media a better, more vibrant, and truly transparently sourced free press, you likely will gain very little ground in your first area of interest. Media activism is for all of us, not just for some scholars or some broadcasters. It's for everyone. And that's why we owe it to ourselves to become more aware, more educated in these areas. Carl Jensen once wrote in the mid-90s this, and I think it rings true today, so I'm going to share it. Jensen wrote that we all will benefit from a more responsible media. We all really then should help bring it about. To do this, the corporate media owners should start to earn their unique First Amendment privileges. Editors should rethink their news judgment. Journalists should persevere in going after the hard stories. Journalism professors should emphasize ethics and critical analysis and turn out more muckrakers and fewer buckrakers. The judicial system should defend the freedom of the press provision of the First Amendment with far more vigor, and the public should show the media it is more concerned with the high crimes and misdemeanors of its political and corporate leaders than it is with the crimes and gossip of celebrities. The effort, Jensen says, will be well worth it. And I think still to this very day, our efforts would be well worth it, and I look forward to joining in those efforts together with all of you how we can. And thank you all so much for coming out.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by myself and Peter Phillips. I'm the executive producer, Mickey Huff, as well as host. Anthony Fest is our senior producer. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. The Project Censored Show airs on nearly 50 stations around the United States, from Hawaii to New York. To learn more about our work or to find any of our previous programs, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and be sure to subscribe to the official Project Censored Show on your cell phone's podcast application. We're also available on YouTube. Please feel free to share your feedback about our work at projectcensored.org. Last but not least, thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguised under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons build the capacity, citizens. And the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu.
We got that love, we flip the brothers in.